Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, February 26, 2011. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. Well, we've just come through another turbulent week with governments all over the world feeling the effects of two simultaneous processes. On the one hand, you have the accelerating breakdown of the global financial system. On the other hand, the spreading rebellion against efforts by governments to impose brutal austerity measures in a vain attempt to save the bankrupt system. And governments all over the world have been shaken by this. Demonstrations have already toppled President Mubarak of Egypt and are now threatening Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. There are revolts throughout North Africa and throughout the Middle East, including food riots this week in Iraq. On top of that, there were hundreds of thousands of people in the streets of India protesting not just high food prices, but also the deregulation of energy and electricity. And the Singh government is, at this point, very weak and possibly the next casualty. The ruling parties in Ireland were punished by the voters there in the election yesterday. We don't have full results as of the moment, but it does appear that the ruling parties had significant drop in their votes. But more importantly, every single party had to adopt the policy of Sinn Féin of saying that they will renegotiate the lousy agreements that were signed, the immoral agreements that were signed with the IMF and the European Union. And now in the United States, we saw a significant expansion of support for demonstrators in Madison, the capital of the state of Wisconsin. And this support has spread to virtually every state in the country. Today, there are demonstrations in almost every single state capital in the United States. And tomorrow, there'll be a large march outside the governor's conference in the National Governor's Conference in Washington, D.C. In every one of these cases, whether it's in the nations around the world or in the states of the United States, the only real issue is that of the breakdown of the economy into a hyperinflationary collapse. And the people are rejecting the corrupt and gutless leaders of the institutions. And the people who are marching want real solutions. They want a real future. So the issue everywhere on the planet is precisely what Lyndon LaRouche has always been saying. It's leadership. Are there leaders with a vision for the future and the guts to fight for it? And will the people then respond to that? Today on the LaRouche Show, I'm delighted to have as my guest someone you've heard from before, Jacques Cheminade. Jacques is a leader of a political party in France, Solidarité et Progrès. He's also the candidate of that party for president of France, and he's a personal friend of mine, and he is the kind of leader needed in such a time of crisis. So, Jacques, welcome to the program.
Welcome to all of you.
Now, this has been an incredible week, and the reason I wanted you on the program today is that you have a unique view of the situation from your situation in France. You've been in Africa recently. You have a sense of the global picture from the top. So why don't you give us your sense of the leading developments of this last week?
Well, it reflects the end of a historical moment. The liberal phase of the British Empire is finished. Now we are at a crossroads. Either we go towards chaos, confusion, and fascistic regimes, or we go towards the solutions that we have always been fighting for, the solutions of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the solutions of common purposes of humanity and a community of development. This needs to crush Wall Street and the British Empire. And we are at the moment when this is possible, because there is, in the peoples of the world, a demand for justice, social justice, a demand for a future, a demand for food, and a demand for freedom. And this is a unity. It's not something that you can separate. It's a unity. And in front of that demand, confronted with that demand, the present leaders of the world are not providing leadership, they are instead abandoning their people. So there is a demand for a new leadership here in Europe, in Africa, in the United States, in the whole world. And this demand for a new leadership, we have to answer to this demand. It's absolutely necessary that we do it as soon as possible, because the situation can turn into something that we can define as a French Revolution, as it turned out, which means a rage, a demand for blood, and a loss of perspective, a loss of perspective of a true government of the people, for the people, by the people. And I remember that in the French Constitution, it's Article 2, it is said that the principle of the French Constitution is a government for the people, of the people, by the people. And we have this principle in our Constitution, but this is lost by our leaders, and it's lost by leaders on the whole transatlantic world. So we have to change that. And
Jacques,
I call each of you to mobilize yourself for that change and to take responsibility to be the leaders for this future society that is absolutely necessary for our youth and for the coming youth, the people that are going to be the future of humanity, not yet born. And these are our true electors, the not yet born.
Up to this point, what we've seen in most of these situations has been not so much the French Revolution, but you actually see the potential for populations to be mobilized if there is leadership. Would you say that's been a characteristic so far?
Yes. Well, what's very interesting is in Egypt, where the population peacefully was a non-violent mobilization, the type of that Martin Luther King wanted, the population managed to get rid of Mubarak, the old dictator who had becoming worse and worse as he was aging. And at the same time, this population, when Mubarak decided to leave, came back to the Tahrir Square where they used to meet, and they started to clean the whole place to make it good and good-looking for the future. So you have this demand from the population. The problem is that there is no response to that demand up to now. So the thing can turn out very sour if we do nothing. For example, in Libya, there were 1.5 million Egyptian workers and 50,000 Tunisians. Well, now they are flying away from Libya, and they go to the Tunisian border. They can't go to the Egyptian border because the East has been taken over by the rebellion. So they go to the Tunisian border, they escape. There are flows of people trying to reach Italy from Tunisia and from now by boat. And the Italian government is a no government with Maroni, who is a minister of interior, and Berlusconi, who are calling for help. And this no government calling for help is finding, as an answer, no governments in Europe helping. Mm. So Germany, Austria, Sweden, and France either express hostility or don't want to welcome these people. They see these refugees as a burden, as invaders, and this immigration question can become very, very soon something which will be a terrible problem in Europe. Already in France, Sarkozy is trying to take advantage of it by launching a debate on secularism against Islam. And Marine Le Pen, who is the extreme right-wing leader, has transformed herself in a proto-Gaullist, but a proto-Gaullist asking for a policy against halal meat, against Islamic habits, and so on and so forth. Mm. So a racist potential, the flames that people are blowing on these flames, it could be very interesting, very, 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 very dangerous.
Yeah, and very dangerous.
And it's interesting, this is what I was about to say, to see that if you have no more tourists in Tunisia, was living mainly on the inputs of tourists, and now it was a necessary bonanza for Tunisians. So now if you don't have an industry, you don't have a development, you don't have something replacing this economy, this type of economy, depending on tourism, then you have a big problem there too. So the question is how we are going in Europe to welcome those that are not invaders but are immigrants wanting a better life, and how are we going to develop Tunisia, Libya, and Egypt? How are we going to give these conditions? And in the present system, it's not done. It cannot be done. So the fight for the Glass-Steagall in the United States is so crucial because it's a key opening the door for a new policy for the community of purpose of mankind.
You're listening to Jacques Cheminade, a candidate for president of France, a longtime collaborator of Lyndon LaRouche, and we're discussing the turbulences around the world. Jacques, one of the things that Lyndon LaRouche has commented on has been the absolutely despicable coverage of the media, which is trying to treat each of these developments as separate, independent. In the case of Egypt, it was demands for democracy against Mubarak. And the media coverage has also, in the United States, tried to separate the developments here around Wisconsin from events in the Middle East, even though we see the participants carrying signs saying Egypt in Wisconsin, or
Governor Walker of Bahrain,
comparing the governor of Wisconsin to Gaddafi. How is it in Europe? In Europe, is there coverage that shows this connection of a one process?
Well, people think about it, but the media try to separate the different aspects of the process as tranches of something. So you have an understanding of that in the population and in the elected officials, local elected officials, that they meet. Look, at this point, the spokesman for the European Commission is saying that he sees no proofs of a relation between food price increase and speculation. Bernanke is saying that in the flow of money, opening all the gates of fake money, he sees no connection with that and the increase of food prices. But in all countries, you have this increase of food prices. Of course, in Egypt or Tunisia, where people spend between 30 and 60% of their income on food, it's a terrible problem. But it's also becoming a problem in Europe, because you have, for example, here in France, a tremendous increase in the food prices. And what's going to come, it's going to be even worse. And it's a price of sugar, it's a price of meat, it's a price of milk, it's a price of everything. And you see coming a mobilization against this food price increase, which is a mobilization against the Sarkozy government. And the problem is that the opposition is that of Dominique Strauss-Kahn. They are bringing in Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who is the director general of the International Monetary Fund, which is Sarkozy painted in rose, in a different color. So you have no leadership provided to the population, and the population more and more wants to find something else, wants something else. So I am meeting in my presidential campaign a lot of local mayors, and these local mayors, what they are saying, we don't want these people from Paris. We want a new leadership. We want something new. And we like what you said in the past because you said the truth. The others did not tell us the truth. You said the truth because you said, like LaRouche did, in the United States, of course, you said that there would be this crisis in 2005, 2006, and even before. You started in 1995 when you were official presidential candidate. You said the truth, the others didn't. And the others knew, but they are liars. And we want to support somebody who is different. And this is what they are saying, somebody who has told us the truth. And the new elected officials, they said, we have a lot of responsibility. We are giving more and more responsibility and no money to meet our responsibility, because the government is freezing all the subsidies sent to the local government. It's like in the United States. Mm-hmm. So now we have a chain of bankruptcy in the département, which is the French division of the country. A département is more or less a third of an American state. And all these places, people have no more money to pay for the special allocations for the old people, no money to pay for special allocations for the youth, and no money to pay for the handicaps. So you have exactly the same problem, taking different forms, but exactly the same problems as in other parts of the world. And this is due to the system. And it's very clear when you see people, you tell them, but Bernanke and the European Commission are saying there is no relation between speculation and the rise in food prices. So why the French banks, so why the American banks, why the British banks create instruments to speculate on food prices and sell it to the population? And the people say, they are trying to corrupt you. And the people say, yes, it's true. We don't want that anymore.
Jacques, you said earlier that there was the danger on the one side of a top-down move from the British, from the City of London, through the European Union, through Obama in the United States, for fascist governments. Now, this is directly related to this question of the argument that we have to cut the budgets in order to keep the bailouts going. There's reaction to this, of course, in Greece, in Ireland. How do you see this developing in France and Germany, the two key countries in Europe, which are, in a sense, facing the same crisis, but trying to pretend they're above it?
Well, unfortunately, in Germany, you have written in the Constitution the principle of a balanced budget, and now Sarkozy wants to enforce it in France. And Sarkozy, the French president, and Merkel, the German chancellor, have made an agreement. It says, first, we bail out the banks. They say that they bail out the states. But in fact, what they do is that they buy on the secondary markets, they buy the bonds from the states who are owned by the banks. So they give money to the banks and pretending to help the states. And at the same time,
that's Bernanke's policy in the United States.
Exactly, it's exactly the same. Yep. And at the same time, they are stifling and the various populations in Ireland, in Greece, and in other countries. But it is happening in France and in Germany too. Because now what they are saying is that as an aspect of the general policy, what they are doing is to control the budgets. Dominic Strauss-Kahn, the socialist candidate, is calling for a European control of the budgets above the parliaments, above the national parliaments. Sarkozy and Merkel are discussing about in the last European country, there are three or four who are indexed wages on the price scale to get rid of that, so to have the wages reduced. In France, for example, in the last 20 years, the portion of the wages in the gross national product has decreased by between 8 and 10%. And also, you have the plan in Europe, at an European level, for a new Europe of 2020. They say a strategy for an intelligent growth, sustainable and inclusive. So what they mean by that is that they want a budget stabilization and financial viability, long-term financial viability. And this should imply structural reforms, notably in the domains of pensions, medical care, and systems of social protection and education. This means a policy of austerity, of brutal austerity against the population.
It's a top-down dictatorship, isn't it?
It's a top-down dictatorship. It's clear. And it's the same type of dictatorship that Henry Kissinger and the British imposed to Mubarak in 1982, to the Egyptian governments in 1982. And now they say, well, we are sorry about the results, we are sorry about what happened. This is highly hypocritical. It's like when Obama is saying, I am for collective bargaining, but it should be restricted, and people should know that there should be a policy of rigor that we should all share. So what is bargaining about for Obama? It's about sharing in the population, sharing austerity and dismantling the social protections. And this is the hypocrisy of the prevailing powers And this hypocrisy leads directly towards this financial fascism. We are entering into that phase if we don't react.
Jacques, let me ask you, is there coverage in France of what's happening in the United States? And before you answer, I just want to make the point so our listeners understand this, that the collective bargaining issue, which is being used by Governor Walker and Kasich of Ohio and others, is really a fraud, because what they've done is they've gotten the unions to accept the idea that they have to have shared sacrifice. Once they've gotten that idea, now they're trying to break whatever power is left of the unions. But it really has to do with the fact that they're taking the focus away from what really caused the budget crisis, which is the breakdown of the economy, and trying to turn it into this idea of shared sacrifice. And even though many of the people demonstrating don't fully understand that, we're seeing polls that show growing sympathy with the demonstrations in the United States. Is any of this reflected in the media in Europe? Do people see this? Is it causing some people to scratch their heads and ask what's going on?
Yeah, it is reflected in some of the media, but it is put in the following way. It is said that it's the ugly Republicans. They are ugly. They are fascist. Yeah. But they say it's the ugly Republicans, and the well-meaning Obama can't do anything about that, but he doesn't agree with them. And this is a big lie, because Obama is mousing certain things that would mean that he would not go so far. But it's like if it was in a concentration camp, and some want to kill the people immediately, and other wants to kill them through hard labor. I am sorry for this comparison, but it's something like that. And it's terrible, because you see the complicity between Obama and these Republicans. And that's the way it works. And people in Europe have not yet realized that, because their own leaders are doing exactly the same thing, right and left. You have Dominique Strauss-Kahn and Sarkozy here, and Angela Merkel and the Social Democrats in Germany. And there is a general agreement of this shared sacrifice approach, and a sacrifice for the people, not for the banks. The banks are provided with the money. So you have the same type of power that gave birth to Hitler and to the Nazi policies. After all, the SS Empire was an inheritor, inherited from the power of all the banks, and made of this empire based on steel, on chemical products, mm-hmm. and the story of Igor Farben is well known, and also concrete, and make this big empire and financial empire, which was a sort of the financial basis for the Nazi regime in Germany. There is a big lie in saying that the SS were good fighters and so on and so forth. They weren't. They were people who were the watching dogs of the German population and the European population. We have in France this building of the Atlantic Wall. The Atlantic Wall was built by French firms, and this Atlantic Wall was not so much against a possible disembarkment of the Americans, but it was to put in a sort of jail the European population, in particular the French population. So people are realizing that. I was in Brittany last week, and we have organized a visit for about 40 of our supporters of the Museum of the Resistance. And what we said is that this resistance in the 40s raised against the German occupation, the Nazi occupation, the occupation of the SS, the occupation of the Gestapo. So now we have a new occupation, which is at the same time a financial occupation and a mental occupation through the counterculture. So we have to do the same thing as our predecessors did. And we have to create the conditions that leaders emerge from the population, emerge through the local powers, who should identify with a national international policy. Mm-hmm. People should raise up to the level of the historical challenge. And this is what we are saying in this country. And it's really creating, at this point, shocks and aftershocks. People are trying to prevent us from speaking, but at the same time, the fact that we are not covering the media is becoming something positive for the people that we meet. They said, if you are not covered in the media, it's because most probably you are very good people.
Well, this comes to one of the key issues, I think, that Mr. LaRouche keeps bringing up, which is that there's a history of the human race which is largely unknown because of the effects of the Anglo-Venetians to prevent it from occurring and one from being known. One of the good examples of that, which you see in France, is the whole story of the French Revolution, which there's a mythology that this was a great moment of French liberation. And, of course, Mr. LaRouche has had an absolutely different view, and I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, because that's highly relevant for the nature of the real basis of the Transatlantic Alliance, which was much more that of the support of patriots in Europe for the American Revolution, and in particular for the credit policy, which the British did everything they could to prevent from occurring in France.
The idea was first from the French state to proclaim bankruptcy against the Swiss and British banks. This was tried by the monarchy and they failed miserably. So there was a motion towards a revolution in part of the elite, of the bourgeois elite and the population. At the same time, the British tried to manage and control this revolution by creating chaos and confusion, and in particular by promoting liberalism. And in the name of liberalism, the centers of stocking wheat were emptied. So the people had no more wheat and they became enraged. At this point, there were leaders in the revolution who could have oriented the anger of the population in a similar way as in the United States. But we had three problems. First is that the leader who was the leader of the first phase of the revolution, Lafayette, the Marquis de Lafayette, was too much benevolent with the habits of the Ancien Régime. So he was unable to take over and to build something new. He did not provide the necessary leadership. Then the second point is that the oligarchy was prevailing in France, of course, much more than in the United States, because the United States have been a project from Europe right from the beginning to create a republic freed from the oligarchy. So we had this weight of the oligarchy in France. And then connected to that, we had a counterculture based not on a conception of man different from the beasts, and a conception of man, a creative human being in the tradition of Leibniz and what some in France at that point called the Enlightenment from the East. But the French-British so-called Enlightenment was extremely different. For them, man was defined by his needs, by his desires, and the desire replaced the thinking. And this desire, this thrust for pleasure and avoidance of pain became the identity. And this created in the minds of the people the incapacity to provide a future, to provide a sense of a policy that would develop the capacity of human being to transform nature and to be in solidarity with the population. So you had
Doc, isn't this one of the real paradoxes in French history, that on the one hand, there's this very real anti-British sentiment, and on the other hand, there was the embrace of the British policies of Sarpi, of Bentham, of Adam Smith?
It's true, but this anti-British ferment doesn't know where the British are. They see when it comes. They see very well when it comes, but they don't see when it develops inside their own country and inside their own mind. So that's a big fight in France, a big fight of the Leibniz Lessing currents, which were represented in France, but a minority. And then the prevailing currents, which was a Voltaire, Diderot, D'Alembert, encyclopedic notion. And then in this notion, knowledge is an accumulation of facts, an accumulation of things, and it's not developing the capacities, the creative capacities of the human being. It's not going to the unknown. It's just making a sort of evaluation of the known and deducting from that something to be done. And it's exactly what LaRouche is saying now. If you do that today, if you deduce in that way, what you are building is a box, and this box is going to become your coffin.
We're talking with Jacques Cheminade, the candidate for president of France, and as you can see, quite a unique, interesting thinker. Jacques, I'd like to come back to the question of the current situation from the standpoint you just developed in terms of history. You recently had a chance to go to Africa. You and I participated in a forum in Paris not that long ago on the discussion of the TransAqua project, the development of new platforms of energy, of culture. What's your sense from the trip there and then looking at these developments? How real is this possibility that we could have a true development project, projects for Africa?
Well, I was exactly at the place where the five Frenchmen and two Africans were kidnapped by Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. So this Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is a sort of joke. These people are cocaine dealers or cigarette pirates. Cigarette pirates. One is called the Imam Marlboro and the other is called Imam Cocaine. So, that's what it is. You have there that developing because there is not a policy of inner development of the country, of Niger, where I was. We met a guy who is a commander, the head, the governor, of one of the eight regions of Niger. And he wrote when he was in France. He's a lieutenant colonel, and he wrote when he was in France a very interesting piece on Lake Chad and on the development of Lake Chad. And this corresponds to the TransAqua project of our Italian friends launched in the 1980s. So this project is so important because it will bring water inside Africa. It will bring development. It will bring industry. It will bring things that correspond to the inner development of this region of Africa, which was always looted. Niger was looted. Cameroon was looted. Chad was looted. Nigeria was looted. All these countries have not a community of purpose because in their minds, the very idea of looting has made its way and people think in that way. So we have to change that. People go, for example, from Niger to the Ivory Coast to make wheels and deals, to sell and buy things, because there is no industry and there is more wheeling and dealing in the Ivory Coast because they have the wells of cacao, which explains many things happening there now. But what you have is this lack of a policy of the community of interest. So this Lake Chad project would bring it. So we are fighting for it. My friend, the Niger ambassador to UNESCO, is fighting for it. And he introduced me in Niamey to all the government, to the ambassadors. They want it. But I met a French friend, and I said, look, these people want that. They want a change in French policy to loot uranium or to take out uranium is something, but to develop the country is another thing, and it should be done. With the profit of the uranium, for example, we should do that. He said, forget it. In France, nobody would go for that at this point. There is no money, there is no will, there is no leadership. So the only way would be to present the project to the Chinese, and the Chinese would be interested, and then it would launch an interest maybe in Europe. But I am adding, if we don't succeed in the United States to bring in the Wanawapa project and this conception of great projects, there would never be a Lake Chad project in Africa. What I am fighting for is to connect this Lake Chad project to the Nawapa project and to other projects. For example, in Tunisia, there is an absolute need to have a development project concerning the Chots, which is the areas of salt lakes in the south of Tunisia. Mm-hmm. So you have to develop that. There was a plan of the French by Roudert, by an engineer called Roudert, back in the 19th century, and nothing has been done since then. So you should bring the water in this place to get the salt out, and then, having done that, you create an area of development for agriculture in the whole region. And, well, this is a great project. It's extremely, it interests the Tunisians. It's a blue revolution by deploying modern means to realize these plans of Roudert to bring fresh water to clean out the salty lakes, these chutes of southern Tunisia, and make it into a grain basket and a center of agro-industrial development. But for that, you need to have money. So to have money, you have to change completely the thinking about money of people today. Money, as LaRouche says, is an idiot. Money depends on what you do with it. If you have a cult of money, it's the you're British. You're Britishized, brutishized. So you need to have money for community, for long-term development. And for that, you have to separate investment banks from deposit banks to break the power of the monetarist oligarchy. And this is not a technical question. It's a political issue.
I was just going to come to that, because clearly what you've just developed in terms of the potential in Africa, and also the potential from the campaigns that you're running in France, as well as our collaborators in Berlin and Stuttgart, it's clear that this would benefit immediately the economies of Europe. But this does require a change in the thinking. And the central issue of that is the restoration of Glass-Steagall. Something that's moving in that direction in the United States was this report of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, the so-called Angelides Committee. And Phil Angelides, who is the chair of the committee, is continuing to campaign and organize around an understanding that, as Lyndon LaRouche has always insisted, this crisis was predictable, it was avoidable, and it was largely the work of Greenspan and the kind of right-wing liberal idiots who pushed for the destruction of government, the destruction of Glass-Steagall. So clearly this is a solution. How effectively are we communicating this in France? And I'd like to ask if there's an awareness yet of the work of the Angelides Commission. Our friends in Denmark just got a parliamentary agreement that there should be such a commission. Is there anything like that in France? And how are you doing with the economists and others in getting them to campaign for Glass-Steagall for Europe?
Yes, there was a commission on the financial crisis, a parliament commission on the financial crisis, and they came out with certain useful comments. But it was on the basis of a general evaluation of the situation. So it was done by two parliament leaders, one from the left, another from the right, who have who have done all their careers in banks. And this commission presented these things in a formal way with no power to subpoena and to bring witnesses to the testimony, and no power to look into the documents of the banks. So this remains at such a general level that there is no way that, like in the Angelides Commission, that you can follow pace by pace what was done. What you have in the report of the Angelides Commission is 80 people working for it, and a very serious work over many, many months. In France, it was just people taking notes, bringing people to say things, and making out of something a document which is relatively relevant but has no depth, because it doesn't go into the situation, the real situation of the French banks. And everybody here in France is saying that the French banks and the German banks are in a better situation than the Anglo-Saxon banks, as they put it. And it's absolutely not true. For example, Banque Nationale BNP Paribas, Banque Nationale de Paris Paribas, the French bank, which is one of the main banks in the whole world, has only 3% of equity corresponding to to the financial exposure. So it's only 3%. It's like the same percentage of all the American banks.
Yes, Citibank, Bank of America, the same problem.
In 2007, 2008.
Yeah.
And again now, what I find very interesting in the Angelidis Commission and what later Phil Angelidis said is that when he was asked, can this happen again? He said, absolutely, it can happen tomorrow because the whole thing has not changed. The whole reforms from Obama, so-called, are not reforms at all. They are only, as they say in France, what they put on the statues to hide the sex. What it is, these Obama reforms.
Yeah.
And they amount to a Gruyere cheese, not a Swiss who has no holes, but a French Gruyere cheese full of holes, like Wall Street can do whatever they want. So it's a scandal. It's a real scandal. And now it's begun to be understood in France. So I have communicated the Angelidis report to about 20 people, and I have... people have not very courageous. They are saying it's true, it's very interesting, it's right, but something should come from the United States. They should take measures from there. Hmm. We are expecting that something would come from there, and then we will move.
Well, Jacques, when I was in France last winter, you and I met with a number of economists who at the time were saying they support the idea of a global Glass-Steagall. Are they doing the same thing? They're just waiting for that to come from the United States first?
They are still saying it. You know, they are not connected to really to the political parties. For example, Martine Aubry, the head of the Socialist Party, we presented her in a private meeting with a Glass-Steagall proposal. And she said, well, I think it's good. I agree. But we asked her, but are you going to do with that an issue for your campaign? And she said, oh, no, because people can't understand that. It's too complicated. It's only a technical issue. So that's a problem. You see that problem? I have a friend of mine who is a very known economist who wrote a book called The World Without Wall Street. A very interesting book. And he praises, nominally, he mentions me, what I said on the Glass-Steagall. And he also thanks me for my contribution together with Lionel Jospin and Jean-Claude Trichet, which is they have this type of, it's funny to be in such
putting
a company.
Putting you in bad company.
Very bad company, bad bedfellows. So these people are like that. They don't want to go too far. What he did is remarkable because nobody would have covered me before. But now he does it, but in that way. So it's not, there is no connection between the thinking, even when the thinking can go in the right direction, and the action. That's the definition of an oligarchy or an oligarchical pressure around you. What you think, what you say, and what you do are three different things.
Hmm. Well, we're coming to the point where the question of Glass-Steagall is increasingly being discussed in the back rooms and on the streets of this country. There are trade unionists who are talking about it. We have a slate of six LaRouche candidates for Congress in 2012 who are making it the issue today. And we're at the point at which the problem is that you have the same kind of cowardice and fear in both the Democratic and Republican parties. So assume we get a breakthrough in the United States, which I think is something that, as Lyndon LaRouche has said, is really very close. If we get something like that, do you expect there'll be an immediate response in Europe?
Oh, here in France, we have three campaigns at the local level, who are like test campaigns of three candidates who are doing pretty well, calling for a new resistance against what De Gaulle had called the world of money, a new resistance against the world of money, and calling, of course, for Glass-Steagall. There was something equivalent in 1945 in France, which was a separation from deposit banks, so-called credit banks, and business banks. It was called like that in France, but there was a separation. And little by little, the thing was, destroyed. And finally, Jacques Delors gave the final kick against it in 1984 under the Socialist government. And it's also Jacques Delors who promoted the euro.
Yeah.
So you see how this problem develops and how it's in the inner elites of France that the bad direction was taken the, let's say, the socialist liberals and the right-wing liberals agreeing in the same direction. So now what we have to change is that, and there are a lot of people jumping in the bandwagon, trying to bring the idea that they are going to change. So you have an extreme right-wing with Marine Le Pen, a certain Mélenchon with a front of the left. But look, Mélenchon in the front of the left, he says, I am for all that, but I am against nuclear energy, and I think geothermy would bring a future to the world for production of energy, so he's crazy. And then you have Marine Le Pen, who is saying, I am for the state, I am for the goal, I'm very different from my father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, who was a national Bonapartist. But she says, the problem is Islam, and we should have the people from Islam as far as we can, and immigration is a threat for Europe and a burden. So you have all these people who are sophists. They present synthetic products, and these synthetic products, they try to make them presentable, to make them good, and the media support them to avoid our ideas to be on the stage. They try to do that, but they are failing at this point, because what I'm saying, a lot of mayors that I met said, you are not on the media, you are a good guy. The Constitutional Council rejected your campaign account of 95. This council accepted the accounts of Chirac and Balladur, who are bad guys. You are a good guy. So what happened in the past is coming as something, as a power for us for the future, provided we act in the good way, without any type of compromising or any type of to go along, to get along. We have to be on top of a break.
Well, what you're describing is a classical example of a revolutionary period where the existing views and the existing habits of people no longer function, no longer work. And the question is, at what point do people decide they're going to take on new leadership? Will they accept new leadership? I assume then, from what you're saying, that you are quite optimistic that our campaigns are heading toward that kind of breakthrough, given that the alternative is becoming increasingly clear, a hyperinflationary collapse and fascism.
What's very interesting, it's a proof of the power of ideas. You know that Helen Keller developed her knowledge of the universe, even if she was blind, because the power is in the mind. So sometimes what we do in Germany, what we do in the United States, what we do in France, what we do in Italy, we don't see, because we have not the means to communicate and to have enough of an immediate common mobilization. But our power is in the mind, and we are doing the same things in the same direction. So if something happened in the United States, it will be like a prairie fire, as you said in America, like a prairie fire coming to France in particular and Germany. Because it's in France and Germany that you have in Europe this capacity of resistance. In Italy, you have some very interesting things, but you have this buffoon Berlusconi and his counterculture that have destroyed a lot this poor country.
Well, and this is, I assume the election is scheduled for 2012 in France?
Yes, it's April 2012, but the election has already started. The whole press is talking about the future, about the next president. It's like we were in the second round of the election. Nobody believes in Sarkozy anymore. He has only a rate of approval of 30% and a rate of rejection of 65%.
Yet he's using his position at the head of the G20 to do a lot of posturing.
Yes, but nobody believes anymore in the clown. The clown has operated for too long in the circus, so nobody believes in the clown. It's like a clown failing every time. He failed on Tunisia. He failed on Egypt. When the head of the government, Fillon, is caught having been on holidays on an airplane provided by Mubarak, the foreign affairs minister, Michel Aoun-Marie, is caught in diverse businesses with the Ben Ali family. When you see that the Ben Ali party and the Mubarak party were still members of the Socialist International less than a month ago, you laugh. You have nothing there. It's finished.
Well, Jacques, let me ask you a personal question, because this has been a very interesting discussion, which I'm sure our American listeners appreciate quite a bit. But I think let's get to this real question of leadership. You've been through a very difficult last couple of decades where you've been fighting, you've been truthful, you've been penalized and attacked by the French state, very much in the way Lyndon LaRouche has been demonized. And yet, here you are coming into this situation still quite optimistic and still fighting for truth. What sustains that sense of optimism in you?
Well, if you see that in an immediate form, first that was done to Lyndon LaRouche was much worse than what was done to me. And the way he reacted is an inspiration, has always been an inspiration for me, because he always reacted it's what the enemy, I think, minds the most, being more and more punchy and more joyful. So on my case also, it's something that comes from my childhood, which is a commitment to above. I was between France and South America, and above these two countries that I like both, Argentina and France, and I feel like a Frenchman because my family was French and we decided to live in France, and I finally decided to make my career in France, my life in France, to do what I had to do in France. But nonetheless, to be between two countries makes you look at things from above. And I have a very interesting quote from a speech that de Gaulle gave in Oxford at the end of 1941. And it's a speech on the crisis of civilization. He said, Hitler is a terrible problem. We have to fight. We have to get rid of Hitler. We have to fight until the bitter end. But there is something more. The crisis of civilization that produced Hitler. And this is what we have to change. And this means and he quotes a famous quote from an Italian poet, you have to climb on top of a mountain to look from above, and it's the only way to understand what happens. And this is what is called education. So this is always what brought me forward, is the sense that I had to know better the universe, that I have to know better human beings, that I have to know better what has been created, and it's the most passionate thing to do in your life. And you know you're going to die as a human, but you try to leave for the future a gift of your life, to give to the future something that's valuable. And then you can die, as Lynn says, often with a smile on your lips, because you have done the right thing. So that's what moved me during all my life, and it's the humanity in a human being. And I think my life, until now, is always learning more and more about what's human in a human being. I would not learn all of it, but I will have fought to reach that level of knowledge, and it's a fight which has been entertaining my optimism.
And also, I know you've been following very closely the work coming out of the basement and the recent papers by Lyndon LaRouche. By the way, let me mention, on March 10th, Lyndon LaRouche will be doing his next webcast. So it's Thursday, March 10th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. It will be on the LaRouche PAC website, and this is the next opportunity for Lynn to take up these global questions. But I know you've been working on these ideas about this question of the ontological nature of the universe as defined by creativity per se. I assume the youth members and our recruitment operations in France are also focusing on these critical investigations into the nature of the relationship between the human mind and the physical universe.
Oh, yes, absolutely. But we need to be more and more committed to that, because it's the only way, it's what I always am telling them, is the only way to feel politically mobilized. If you do that, if you develop your mind continuously, without stopping, to intervene in a better way in the universe where you have where you are, of which you are a member of. And there is something in common with the universe, which is its permanent creation, and yourself, and your creative mind. And your creative mind, through your will, can assimilate the principles of the universe, develop them, and in turn, act on the basis of this principle and transform the universe, being creator in the as a creation of universe, he is being creator in the image of the creator, what the Christian tradition calls Capax Dei. And I found it very funny because I was reading one night that I could not sleep, something about I was reading an Indian Veda, and I found this notion of the sixth sense that LaRouche is developing now, saying it's a sense of the mind. So it's very funny that this sixth sense, in a much more scientific way, comes back into the history of human thinking in the form of this development that LaRouche and the Besmond have launched in the sense of connected to the cosmic radiations. And I found that very, very interesting. Which
well, I
means
think
that
also,
that's a dialogue of cultures.
Sure. And I think also what we see is, as we see the unfolding of this mass strike ferment globally, that we can explain it, we don't fully understand it, but we can explain it from the standpoint of this higher potential of man, the yearning of man for something which is better, and the fight against that which would tend to make us comfortable with the traditions and the bad habits. But you get to a break point in history where there's a window of opportunity for change, and I think this is a point that Helga LaRouche has been stressing. This window is open now. Will the French people follow you through it, Jacques?
Will the French people?
Follow you through this window of opportunity to create this change.
Oh, yes. The French people have a sense of it. And they want to get rid of the politicians that have controlled the political game. I was with one of them who told me, I don't want to meet you, one mayor. I don't want to meet you anymore. You have attacked Dominique Strauss-Kahn. So I said, but do you like Dominique Strauss-Kahn? He said, no, but he's the only one that can get us rid from Sarkozy. So I said, this is what we were saying about Obama. Obama was the only one that can get rid of Bush and the Republicans, and look what happened. And he said, oh, yes. And the only way to change a person, if Strauss-Kahn may be changed, which I don't think, is to yell at him, to attack him, to don't leave a moment of complacency towards him, and to be all the time on the front. And he said, well, yes. And finally he signed to support my candidacy. So that's funny, because people are realizing that the will to fight is something that has to be connected to the ideas. In France, you have, because of this influence of the oligarchy, what I also see in Germany and other countries, the world of ideas and the world of how the ideas are acted upon in reality. This difference you don't have in the United States. Maybe some people, some Americans, have less ideas, less knowledge of history, but when they have some, they want immediately to act upon them to improve the universe. In Europe, you have this thing that in a moment, it's only in a moment of extreme emergency that people make this connection between the ideas and the way to act upon these ideas in the best they can. And this is happening now. It depends upon us, and we are very little. It depends upon us to steer this development and to make it, of that, a transatlantic connection and to change the transatlantic world. Because if this transatlantic world doesn't change, it's a collapse of the whole economy in the world, and it's, for two or three generations, a tremendous collapse and a tremendous reduction of population, as they say in England, but in fact, this is called genocide.
Well, it's a compelling moment. It's a time where change is possible. There's a new paper that's available from Lyndon LaRouche that's up on the LaRouche PAC website called The Lesson of the FCIC Report, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Report, When Statisticians Have Wished to Lie. And this is the kind of input from LaRouche which is absolutely crucial to develop the leadership that we need to get through this crisis. Jacques, I want to thank you for coming on with us today and wish you a lot of luck with your campaign. Obviously, it's not luck. It's a question of hard work, and no one knows that more than you.
I will do my best. Thanks
okay.
a lot.
So, and don't forget, put on your calendars, March 10th, the next webcast from Lyndon LaRouche, where he'll be, who knows where the world will be by March 10th. No one.
We had 60 people in our Paris local last time.
That's right.
For the webcast, for Lynn's webcast.
So I know you'll be building for a bigger one this time. All right, and give all our best regards to our LaRouche Youth Movement members in France. Jacques, thanks for joining us today, and we'll be back next Saturday with the next edition of the LaRouche Show.
My best to you all.